Welcome back to Season 4 of Media Minded, the show that guides you through the age of disinformation. In this episode, we will confront the worrying trend plaguing the minds of world leaders, business tycoons, academic experts, and everyone in between, the crisis of democracy in West Africa. This podcast is produced by Shoutout UK, the leading political and media literacy education platform, and is made possible by the generous support and sponsorship of the Global Engagement Center at the US State Department. I am your host, Atil Bergamini, founder and CEO of Shoutout UK, here to challenge your understanding of the world around you, and hopefully not your attention span. To understand current African tensions with the West, we're going to have to turn back time a couple of centuries. The so-called Scramble for Africa started in the late 19th century when European powers like France and the UK expanded quickly and greedily into West Africa. Drawn in by the land's rich deposits of natural resources, these colonial nations had one goal in mind: money. Until the 1880s, Africans still controlled 90% of the continent. By 1914, Liberia and Ethiopia were the only African countries not under European rule. The effects of imperialism were far-reaching and permeated almost every aspect of economic, political, and social life as Europeans upended the continent. Communities were decimated by war, populations were subjected to forced labor, and economies became completely reliant on and in service to Europe. The scars of this era run deep. While Africa was largely decolonized during the Cold War, the colonial boundaries and economic systems continue to impact Africa's politics and economy today, and a resentment for a century of colonial rule endures. All of this is to say Africans have a complex history and mixed feelings towards Westerners. Fast forward to more recent times. Starting in 2020, a wave of military coups tore through the continent, including four in West Africa. In the wake of these coups, anti-Western sentiment skyrocketed, something that violent extremist organizations have spurred on. For example, after the 2023 coup in Niger, a former French colony, the new government expelled French diplomats and crowds waved Russian flags at rallies supporting the new government. To learn more about how anti-Western sentiment is manifesting in West Africa and how violent extremist organizations capitalize on it to further their propaganda, I spoke to Boulama Bukharti. Boulama is a senior analyst in the Extremism Policy Unit of the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change, where he focuses on violent extremist groups in sub-Saharan Africa. Boulama is also a trained human rights lawyer, holding a degree in common and Islamic law, as well as a Master of Laws degree, and spent 10 years teaching as a professor in Nigeria.
There is a strong anti-Western sentiment across West Africa, especially Francophone West Africa, but also Anglophone West Africa. But in Anglophone West Africa, anti-state sentiment is mostly historical rather than present. And most of it stems from two major things. Number one is the history of colonialism. And the second factor is Western policy in the Middle East. When it comes to the history of colonialism, what you see extremist scholars and groups paint is a rosy picture of a historically utopian society, a society that was in peace and harmony and was in prosperity before the British colonial masters arrived. And remember that in Nigeria, in northeastern Nigeria, there was a powerful Islamic caliphate, the Kanem Borno Empire, which existed for a millennium before the arrival of the British colonial masters. And then, of course, in northwestern Nigeria, there was the Sokoto Caliphate, spanning to parts of Niger, Burkina Faso, and even Cameroon. And then in Mali, you had other empires. So there was a deeply rooted history of Islam and Islamic practices and empires in that part of the world. And so what extremist groups do is to paint a picture of Islamic empires that were peaceful, and prosperous, which were then destroyed by colonial masters, and in whose place Western or secular style governments and schools and systems and institutions were built. That is not completely true, because if you read history even for a bit, you would understand that there were internal problems in those empires, and it was not as peaceful and prosperous as Boko Haram and others, or as united as they want to portray. But then, I mean, that's one feature of all groups, not just Boko Haram, not just so-called jihadi groups, but also white nationalist groups, far-right groups. They always have this, this time in history, the golden age that they always go back to. And it is why where we are today. And they can exploit the history today because they can show with hard, tangible evidence on the ground that the Western-style democracy is not working as people would want it to work on the ground, whether in terms of corrupt politicians or in terms of oppressive, corrupt police officers, whether in terms of just things not working. And you know, when people have lots of socioeconomic and political problems on the ground, they are always looking for an easy answer, an easy solution, And perhaps the best way to do that is to accuse an external factor. And that external factor was colonialism, which they then argue that it continues to exist today because the governments we have in Africa are puppet regimes, whether in terms of the language they speak or the systems they implement. And they use lots of, stuff to try to support that. That's happening in Anglophone West Africa, but in Francophone West Africa, it is even stronger because of France's foreign policy with its former colonies.
Here, Boulama raises a critical point. The frustrations of the present are often intertwined with the narratives of the past. This sentiment runs even deeper in former French colonies than others. Violent extremist organizations like Boko Haram paint a romanticized, mythical picture of Africa before colonialism, conveniently erasing its complexities. This fairy tale Africa serves as a stark contrast to the present challenges faced by many African nations, readily blamed on Western democracy and the legacy of colonialism. This narrative is particularly dangerous as it resonates with genuine frustrations. Boulama highlights how bad governance, poverty, and inadequate education create fertile ground for extremist ideologies to take root. These grievances are real, but the solution offered by terrorists is a dangerous distortion of history. Moreover, the story that terrorists spin goes beyond just blaming the West or a democratic style of governance for its problems. Instead, it actively puts a target on the back of local leaders, employing pent-up resentment from colonialism and underlying societal problems to justify horrific acts of violence.
What happens is that after this version of history is presented, or while it is being presented, then what it comes with then is a portrayal of current local governments or local leaders as puppets of the West. So what groups like Boko Haram typically argue is that they would tell you colonialism has ended today, but before they went, they installed their systems which trained their people in our skin. And so what you see in Abuja, the people you see in Abuja, the people you see in the government house, Borno State Government House or Yobe State Government House, or in the office of the president of Niger, are people who are only black in skin, but they are white in their ideology and their practices. And that's why we are bedeviled with all the socioeconomic problems that are going on today. Now, these local leaders are mostly Muslims, especially in Nigeria. But once you are able to define them as puppets of the West, then they get excommunicated. Excommunication is the sense that takfir is conducted on them. They are declared as non-Muslims and then made legitimate targets. Muslim scholars who support them or who advocate for the system are also defined in that way. And so, number one, they have been delegitimized, but also, secondly, they are made permissible targets.
Extremist groups like Boko Haram thrive on twisted narratives, manipulating both history and recent events to sow seeds of discontent. They portray local leaders as puppets of the West, eroding trust and delegitimizing their authority. This, as Boulama chillingly described, creates a dangerous environment where leaders and their supporters are deemed permissible targets. But there's a powerful weapon against this manipulation of the past, truth. And the first step towards countering extremism is to educate communities about their true history.
The way to counter it is perhaps to start by teaching or enlightening communities on their true history. And I say this as someone who did most of my education in Nigeria, and I don't see in the history that was taught in the so-called Western style schools that has empowered me to challenge any of those any of the items they exploit in the history, because we essentially don't tell Africa's history in the way it should be taught, in the sense that Africa's history mostly in schools, in Western style schools, starts with colonialism. And so because it started with colonialism, you leave even in the mind of those graduates of the schools like myself, this blind spot that can easily be filled by groups that would come and say, oh, they don't tell you about the history before colonialism because of this, because of that. And so I think the first thing to do is to perhaps immunize people, vaccinate people in the very beginning by teaching them the good and bad of their history. And of course, then discuss colonialism frankly. It has its good sides and its bad sides. And I think the more people understand the good and the bad, then they would be able to know that, history is not a one-way trajectory. It is, it comes with all the side, the bad and the good, the bad and the ugly. And I think in that way, then people would be more realistic.
Without being educated on one's history and having the critical thinking skills to question, violent extremist organizations have the power to exploit the events of the past, building toxic narratives used to fuel violence and stoke Western hate. In this way, information, or the lack of it, serves as a war-fighting function. Echoing Boulama's words, we as a society need to teach the good, the bad, and the ugly in order to build a resilient and educated society, capable of challenging the myths of propaganda. Pivoting back to what stokes anti-Western sentiment in the West, Boulama also asserted that there is a second factor in play, American policy in the Middle East. Imagine a land sacred to many religions, including Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, a boiling pot of religious fervor. Now, throw in a long and intricately complicated history of conflict, and you have the tinderbox that is the Israel-Palestine region. The US, with its seemingly unwavering support for Israel, a Jewish state over Palestine, a Muslim state, is seen by many Muslims as evidence that the Western world is trying to quash Islam. This argument is powerful as most Islamic jihadist groups look at everything through the lens of religion, more than nationality or other markers of identity. Q. Boulama, who further explained the importance of the Palestinian question to Islam.
One thing that unites most Muslims across the world, whether they are Sunni or Shia, whether they are, I mean, whatever strand of Islam, one issue that unites every one of them is the Palestinian question. Of course, we know that that area of land is important to all religions because of its historic significance. For Muslims, the third holiest mosque is sited in that area. And so many Muslims across the world see liberating the mosque, as they would call it, as a collective endeavor that the Palestinians are representing. And so anything against that project is seen as an attack by many, as an attack on Islam.
The ongoing war in Gaza, part of Palestinian territory, has rocked the entire globe, dividing countries, alliances, and people. Jihadist groups have galvanized support as they claim to be the only solution to stop the alleged onslaught on Islam. To find out more, I turn to Aliyu Dahiru, the head of the radicalization desk at the media outlet Humangle. He spent his career covering communities in Nigeria affected by conflict and insurgency, and has a passion for analyzing jihadism in Africa. Aliyu explained how violent extremists in West Africa are capitalizing on pro-Palestinian sentiment in the largely Muslim region to bolster their messaging and recruitment. He asserts that Boko Haram and ISWAP don't even need to be operating in Gaza to invigorate support, as they view the war in Gaza as a war on Muslims.
The jihadists are not really interested in Palestine, but they use the sentiment, the Palestinian struggle and everything, and say that Muslims are being killed, or Muslims are being killed, and therefore we have to go and fight. And the fighting starts from killing the near enemy. So any Muslim or any person who is not in agreement with what they are doing, he may be considered, you know, an apostate or somebody who is against us. So if you are not with us, then you are against us. So that is why they are using Palestinian sentiments, even though they don't really go there. But they use the Palestinian sentiment as a starting point to branch which any recruit.
Essentially, violent extremist organizations are using the war in Gaza to validate their claims that the West is trying to destroy Islam. And unfortunately, it's working. Boko Haram is manipulating emotions, fear, and misinformation to drive their recruitment and fuel the fire of anti-Western rhetoric. Aliyu pointed to the power of social media to publicize one's support of Palestine, used by extremists and civilians alike.
Because now people understand the power of social media.
Mm.
So even if they know they don't need to carry a gun for them to fight for Palestine or to support Palestine or Gaza, they just need their Twitter or X or Facebook and come on there and, you know, be pushing their support for Palestine there. So they don't need to carry a gun. And they know that there is no way you can go to Palestine to support it. You don't need to be there.
Social media has been instrumental in making news and events from around the world accessible to the everyday person. Social media has also transformed into an essential tool used by extremists to spread their rhetoric. While the war in Gaza may be the most obvious recent event emboldening the jihadist cause, it's certainly not the only one. Listen to Boulama explain how other world events, from the 2021 Taliban takeover in Afghanistan to the COVID-19 pandemic, affect the propaganda and messaging tactics of violent extremist groups in West Africa, and even inspire hope for eventual victory.
One of the major events that you would remember is the fall of Afghanistan back to the Taliban. And what we saw immediately after that was congratulatory messages from many groups operating in Africa, but also internal mobilization that, look, the Afghans have succeeded 20 years after they had started the struggle. And that's a testament that victory is coming. It may take long, but it is coming. So keep fighting. Continue to be on the message and on continue the on the cause. Victory is coming. And so this is one example of how Afghanistan was exploited. When it came to COVID, so initially, the exploitation did not start because COVID did not arrive in Africa at the time it was expected. I mean, it was forecast. And when it finally was found on the continent, it did not do the kind of damage it did in the West. But if that had happened, we would have seen major exploitation. But then even though COVID wasn't a big thing in terms of the fatalities on the ground for the disease, the economic policies that were, or the social distancing policies like lockdowns that were imposed on countries in Africa, the travel bans did affect countries' economies. And so the first thing we saw two different messages. The some groups argued that COVID itself was a Western conspiracy that was intended to stop Muslims from worshiping, especially lockdown in Nigeria started around Ramadan. Shekau's argument at the time was that COVID restrictions were brought in order to destroy Ramadan, in order to stop Muslims from congregational prayers, from attending mosques. And you know, there were many state governments in Nigeria and across West Africa that stopped people from going to mosques, just like churches and other places of worship and markets were closed down. But then they said, look, they wanted to destroy Ramadan. That is why they are implementing this a few weeks before Ramadan. It is all Western conspiracy. And so there is this part that did not believe in COVID and tried to. But then at the same time, other groups, or even the same group, would argue that yes, COVID was real, but it is a disease that was sent by God because we disobey God. And the best way, the only way to cure COVID was to return to God. And the way to return to God is to join these groups because they claim to be religious groups. But we also saw it in the Sahel, like with the Al-Qaeda affiliates in the Sahel, Jama'atul Nusrat al-Islam wal-Muslimin, arguing that COVID was the soldier of Allah that was sent to the West to kill people in the West because the West has disobeyed God. And therefore, it is COVID was an ally of Al-Qaeda in their interpretation of COVID. And so they keep calling people to join. And they say the only reason why it didn't take hold in their areas is because they obey God. And therefore, joining the group in order to promote the cause is the way to deal with the pandemic or the disease.
The fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban sent a frightening message to Islamic jihadist groups. One of perceived validation. Victory is coming, they claim. This message, however, proved adaptable. When COVID arrived, extremists seized on economic hardship brought about by lockdowns, spinning a web of conspiracy theories. Some claimed COVID was a Western plot to undermine religious practice, while others saw it as a divine punishment for societal ills, a disease only curable through adherence to their cause. Moving away from shadowy extremists for a second, Bulama also sheds light on a seismic shift happening right now in West Africa. A wave of coups is ripping through the region, and the new regimes are making a drastic U-turn. Gone are the days of cozying up to the West. Instead, these new leaders are extending their arms towards Russia. Just look at Mali. Since their 2021 coup, the historic French presence has practically vanished, replaced by a growing Russian influence. And the trend continues. In Niger, after the 2023 coup, pro-junta protesters filled the streets, not waving national flags, but Russian ones. This isn't just about optics. These new governments, which came to power through anti-democratic means, are capitalizing on simmering anti-Western sentiment to forge new alliances, often to the detriment of their own people.
Since the military coup, we saw an uptick in both the frequency of attack, but especially in deadliness. So attacks have increased by like around 20%, but the lethality of attacks has tripled over the past 2 years in the Sahel. And I think that's because of the vacuum left by the UN peacekeeping mission that left the Sahel, by the French 13,000 French troops that left, which left a big vacuum on the ground. That vacuum was supposed to be filled by the Russians, by Wagner in particular. But we know that the Russians neither have the political will nor the capacity with the Ukraine war to bring peace back to countries like Mali or Niger, especially Mali, where they started operating after the coup. Now, that's for two reasons, of course. Number one, we know that Russia's Wagner, or Russia as a country, might show some success in places like Syria, where it was fighting nationalist governments, or the Central African Republic, where they were fighting nationalist groups. But Russia's record in fighting violent extremist groups claiming to fight for Islam, the so-called jihadi group, is dismal. They do not have good record of fighting those groups. Now, secondly, what we saw after the military takeovers was Western sanctions, as well as sanctions by regional organizations, African regional organizations. And what the military did typically was then to say, look, these regional organizations like ECOWAS are imposing sanctions on us because they are agents of the West, because they are agents of the US and the European Union. And so that only continued to drive the anti-Western sentiment, especially in places like Niger and Mali today. But also the economic impact of the sanctions, and I am not arguing one way or the other whether we should have sanctions, but the economic impact of the sanctions was making people poorer, making hungry people hungrier, and then making them more vulnerable to violent, to recruitment by violent extremist groups.
Boulama painted a concerning picture. A security vacuum in the Sahel region following the departure of peacekeeping forces. This void, he argued, was supposed to be filled by the Russians, specifically the Africa Corps, formerly known as the Wagner Group. However, this solution comes with its own set of problems. Boulama takes this a step further. He explained how Russia, which provides security services to several West African countries, has an incentive to maintain instability, i.e., violent extremism, in the countries in which it operates.
We know from the very beginning, when Russia started in places like Mali, they do not have the political will. Russia's foreign policy, especially in places like Africa, is to create clientele states. It is not like making states prosperous and then partnering with them for the mutual benefits of all. If your business is providing security, you will want crisis to continue. And so the philosophy in the first place is not to help governments to fight instability. And I think that's the difference between the West and Russia when it comes to places like Africa.
The idea that Russia might be propagating, or at least tolerating, violent extremism in places like Mali for its own economic benefit is a frightening prospect. It paints a picture where the fight against terrorism becomes a twisted game of chess, with innocent lives as pawns sacrificed on a board of geopolitical maneuvering. Let's turn back to talking about violent extremist groups. While today's terrorist groups like Boko Haram and ISWAP are leveraging current anti-Western views to fuel their propaganda and recruitment, their playbook and its ideas are nothing new. Radical ideologies and resentment towards the West have existed for years. Extremist groups in the past have tried to take advantage of these feelings and ideas to further their own interests. Even more, the pitting of groups against each other is a tale as old as time, and has fueled major world conflicts across history, from the Crusades to World War II. Aliyu pointed out that looking at Boko Haram and its ideology as one phenomenon is dangerous, and that killing off the group militarily won't kill off the ideology. Despite the fact that Boko Haram does not wield as much power as it used to, the destruction and fear caused by the group in the past is fresh in people's minds.
I think the biggest concerns is the fear of resurgence. You know, many people have this experience of these terrorists coming and bombing them, coming to bomb people in market areas, in mosques, in schools, and many large gatherings. So there is this big fear and the concern that these people may resurge, these people may come back, these people may do what they have done like a decade ago, or even less than a decade ago, around 2016, when they started to dwindle, you know, started to be pushed back. So this is a major fear in the people, among the people. And that's why when you look at into the people, even though they are optimistic that these stories will be overpowered, but most of people who are following this issue with a kind of scientific curiosity, most of them know that this is not something that could be ended just like that, just with a kinetic approach. This can't be ended with killing the terrorists, because it's an ideology. It's something that may emerge. It's something that may come back. So the biggest fear and the concern is that these people may come back, because the ideology is there. The approaches, the situation that brought about Boko Haram in northern Nigeria, or in Nigeria in general, or in Lake Chad, is there. You know, they are there. The social concerns, you know, the political nature, the ideology that breed these kind of people is still there. The economic issues, everything is there. So even though the kinetic approach has made them, or has rendered them, has pushed them into the poorest areas, and they are no longer attacking people in general, like they are no longer coming into the cities, bombing people, but there is still concern that these people may come back, and that will be hell on people.
Aliyu highlights an unsettling truth. Defeating the people might not be enough. As he suggests, an effective counter-terrorism strategy needs more than just a military offensive. Terrorist groups come and go, but the ideology often endures for generations, getting reinvented to fit the current trends.
And let me tell you, for those people who are very certain on Boko Haram, they know that Boko Haram is not the only or the first insurgent group in northern Nigeria that clings to the ideology of killing people, or takbir, or is communicating people. It's not the first one. There were many, even though some of them as violent as Boko Haram, but they didn't last as long as Boko Haram. It's now a kind of a military affair. They are using kinetic approach to do this and that. But for me, who knows that kinetic approach will not solve the problem? I know this thing is really difficult. As you have said, education is the answer, but really it's a large answer. It's a big answer to the problems.
As suggested by Aliyu, and Baluma earlier in this episode, it's education that inoculates the next generation against the vulnerabilities and follies of the current one. A truly successful counter-terrorism strategy needs to be holistic. It needs military and social and political components that address the conditions that allow this ideology and anti-Western sentiments to ferment. Only then can we hope to break this cycle and build a future where the fear of resurgence becomes a distant memory. Lastly, I asked Boulama if there are any lessons learned for how to stop the spread of anti-Western sentiment in West Africa. What can we as a society do to bring back a favorable image of democracy?
With the offline dissemination of the ideology, I think one lesson that I think we haven't learned enough over the past 20 years or so is how best to work with religious and traditional groups on the ground in order to counter that kind of messaging. And I think the best candidates might be Muslim scholars or clerics and groups who are already doing fantastic work on the ground, but whose capacity is limited in terms of how to fight extremist narratives on the ground. But I think when it comes to the real issues on the ground, what obviously does need to happen is for democracies to prove on the ground that they can deliver. Because what you see is a large onslaught against democracy on democracy by these groups. Anti-democracy narratives is one of the five major pillars of Boko Haram. And what they typically do is to expose how democracy did not work on the ground. And I think the lesson Western partners and local leaders or local Nigerian politicians must learn is to understand that the social contract, which has been fragile for a long time, is almost breaking now, especially in the areas where these groups are thriving. And I think it's something we do need to note. All of the groups that are operating in Africa, maybe with the exception of Al-Shabaab, are operating in border communities. And these border communities are communities, number one, who have a weak sense of national identity. There is very little government presence on the ground. The borders are porous, so arms and ammunition can easily be imported. And so you would see that in the Lake Chad region, Boko Haram operates in the, is it quadrat border area, Niger, Nigeria, Cameroon, and Chad. In the Sahel, it is Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. And so governments, in addition to the to counter messaging, do need to reach out to these communities. And reaching out to these communities might mean better socioeconomic policies, because in the medium and the long run, we do need to fight the socioeconomic and political grievances driving these groups. But in the short run, it might just mean local politicians reaching out to these communities in the sense of giving them a feeling of belonging just through dialogues, bringing them in a hall, in a room with security, intelligence leaders, and politicians. Because what you see is mass profiling and arresting or detention or extrajudicial killings of locals, which is feeding violent extremism. And what you do need to do in some cases is to bring the parties into a room so that communities can air their grievances and intelligence and security heads can explain themselves. And then they can both find a way of fighting the common enemy rather than seeing themselves as enemies of each other. So it is better socioeconomic policies, better educational policies, better paying jobs, especially in border areas. But I think any act, any kind of activity or event that will better strengthen the social contract, give people some sense of belonging to their country, will help. And that could be simple dialogues. It could be issuing national ID cards to individuals around border communities. It could be local politicians visiting them to hear them out. We can do simple things, but maybe one of the simplest things we can do, the lowest hanging fruits, is for state security forces to stop human rights abuses. In the case of Boko Haram, a United Nations report released in September 2017 found that 71% of those who joined Boko Haram after the war had started joined, their tipping point was human rights abuses by state forces against them or their family. And I think we cannot convince societies that governments, democratically elected governments and state forces, are different from the extremist groups if both of them are violating communities and committing human rights abuses. Worse still, if these extremist groups are like ISWAP, who is now adopting a policy of winning the hearts and minds of local people. So stopping human rights abuses, stopping corruption by state forces, stopping impunity by state forces is important, and I think is the lesson we can learn right now, which states can implement right now, and it will go a long way in dissuading people from joining violent extremist groups. And finally, in the medium term, it is about building institutions, because many of the crises that predated violent extremism and that is feeding violent extremism is about weak state institutions, weak judiciary, weak security forces, and or security sector. And then at the end of the day, that leads to local grievances against governments and politicians that is then exploited by violent extremist groups.
Bulama speaks to a glaring vulnerability in the fight against terrorism, and one that the state has the power to fix: the breaking social contract between the government and its people. Boko Haram thrives on this, especially in border communities, and addressing this breakdown will necessitate a multi-pronged investment in state institutions, the creation of a strong national identity, and the training of security forces in how to dismantle violent situations in a humane way. I'm not going to lie, this is a daunting task, but my conversations left me with a glimmer of hope and the start of a roadmap to success. Conversations like this one serve as a reminder of the collective role we all have to play in the battle against violent extremism and radicalization. By addressing these issues, we can create an environment where communities and governments can work together to defeat a common enemy, not see each other as one. Remember, this fight against violent extremism and radicalization is not the sole responsibility of governments or security forces. It's a collective endeavor, a responsibility we all share. By engaging in discourse, challenging harmful ideologies, and growing our critical thinking skills, we can build a world where we stand united, not divided, against this evil. Thank you once again to Bulama and Aliyu for sharing their insights and expertise. Their voices serve as a powerful reminder that even in the face of immense challenges, progress is possible. To our listeners, thank you for tuning in to season 4 of Media Minded, the show guiding you through the age of disinformation. This podcast is produced by Shoutout UK. Make sure to follow Shoutout UK on X and Instagram to get updates on all our upcoming episodes. And don't forget to subscribe to the Media Minded podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast fix. This podcast is made possible by the generous support and sponsorship of the US State Department. Thank you for listening, and remember, stay informed.